Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, tons of discarded plastic are choking off the ocean, killing wildlife, and building islands of garbage. How bad has it become, and what can be done? Then, Occupy Central, a group of pro-democracy advocates in Hong Kong, have vowed to shut down Hong Kong's financial district should China change its freedom to nominate candidates democratically. What does this mean for democratization in Hong Kong and for the region? Finally, highlights from United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's speech delivered at the University of Auckland last week. The ocean is awash with plastic, so much so that giant patches of discarded plastic items, toothbrushes, bottles, bags, are forming in the Pacific Ocean. Plastic pieces are killing off wildlife that swallow or get choked by them. What can be done about the mounds and mounds of plastic that is killing off our ocean life? With us is Charles Moore. He is the founder of the Algalita Marine Research and Education Institute in Long Beach and a captain in the U.S. Merchant Marine. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Charles Moore. It's great to have you here with us.
Great to be with you.
So you recently returned from a trip to research these garbage patches in the ocean. If you could start helping us understand what exactly these garbage patches are and how many are there.
They are fairly stable current systems in the ocean that are under high pressure cells, and they are north and south of the equator, about the latitude of terrestrial deserts. So they're what we call the subtropics. They're in between the equatorial zone, which is tropical, and the northern zone, which is arctic and cold. So this is moderate temperatures and dominated by high pressure. High pressure simply means that the weight of the atmosphere above these areas is greater than in other parts of the Earth. That's because the air is heated at the equator and rises and creates these mountains of air over the mid-latitudes before they condense and come down in the poles. So this mountain of air that's over these subtropical zones descends in a clockwise rotation in the northern hemisphere and in a counterclockwise rotation in the southern hemisphere. And as it descends in this gentle movement, it pulls on the surface of the ocean. So over time, it creates very stable either clockwise currents that rotate and scour the coastlines of the associated continents, or in the southern hemisphere, counterclockwise rotations that do the same thing. So basically what you have is a kind of a toilet bowl effect, I call it, where you're scouring the edges of the toilet bowl, which is the continents that release most of this debris, and bringing it into the center, which acts as a kind of a accumulator for the trash. So these gyres don't grow. A lot of people ask me, well, is the gyre getting bigger? No, the gyres are determined by these geostrophic forces. So it's not the gyres that are increasing in size. What's happening is that the debris that is being accumulated by these gyres is increasing. And so we're starting to see it on the periphery more and not just in the center of these garbage patches.
There are how many garbage patches now?
Five major ones, North and South Atlantic, North and South Pacific, and the Indian Ocean are the major oceanic gyres, and they cover approximately 40% of the world ocean, which if you work that out, it's close to a quarter of the Earth's surface is actually these gyres. Now, they're all remote from land, so they're not a place where, say, for instance, a recreational boater or even a commercial boater would hang out. The same forces that create a terrestrial desert are creating these oceanic deserts, and because they're in the deep ocean away from land, and they're not in, you know, Arctic areas where there's a lot of runoff and they're getting a lot of nutrients, they're nutrient poor. They're what we call depauperate. So in the same sense that a terrestrial desert is devoid of life, except for some hardy species, that's also true of these garbage patches. The only thing I would say that differentiates them from a terrestrial desert is that there's a lot of ocean juvenile species that go to these gyres because they're devoid of large predators that grow up. So small sea turtles and small mola mola, a kind of a fish without a tail that grows to an enormous size. These juveniles hang out in these gyres, these garbage patches. So the fact is that they don't have a lot of life, but the life that they do have is at a very important life stage when it's growing up there. And the fact that we're filling it up with all this plastic waste is having a devastating effect on those juvenile species.
So these gyres are really just islands of plastic garbage.
I would call them more a soup of plastic garbage, not an island. When I first discovered it in 1997, it was just a piece here and a piece there. But now that I'm back 15 years later, because I say 15 years after 1997, because we didn't really take research equipment out there till 1999 and trawl and get quantitative estimates of the amount of plastic in these garbage patches. So it's been 15 years since we really started measuring and monitoring. And what we do out there is unique in the world of garbage gyres, because most people don't have the wherewithal to go except for one trip on a very sporadic basis. But we've actually been back to the same 11 stations and monitored them over this 15-year period. So we have a running data set of how it's been changing, and I can tell you it's been changing dramatically for the worse. It's growing in quantity of the debris. Now, when I first went out there, people said to me, well, what is it like? Are you like an icebreaker going through, you know, plastic waste that you're just bumping out of your way? And I said, oh, no, it's nothing like that. It's just a piece here, and maybe 5 minutes later I'd see another piece. Well, you know, 10 years after that, it was about 10 pieces per minute that we would spot. So it had increased. Now, and 15 years later, in 2014, there's so much stuff there that it is like being an icebreaker. You're going through so much junk, and you can't even count how much is going by the boat. It's that much worse.
Where is it predominantly coming from? Or is this coming from everybody all over the world throwing plastic into the trash?
We always want to combat pollution by looking to find the worst and combat that first. It's just the way that resources are allocated. You allocate resources to combating the worst first. But in the case of plastic pollution, it's such a what we call a non-point source pollutant that you can't locate the worst offender. You try as you will, you can't find who's the worst, because there is no single individual source. It's not a point source, it's a non-point source. And now that even the remotest tribes and the most primitive civilizations wear polyester t-shirts that they've been given by somebody who's visited there, these polyester t-shirts are shedding thousands of fragments every time they're washed. Everybody on the planet now is a contributor. These polyester fragments have gotten so much into the seafood that the average European shellfish eater was just shown in a study to consume 11,000 synthetic fibers in their shellfish consumption each year. So these fibers are everywhere in the environment. These garbage patches accumulate the floating stuff, but the stuff that sinks to the bottom is in somewhere else. We've fundamentally changed the nature of the ocean itself into the synthetic polymer soup. And I don't think we have anywhere near the information that we need to say what the consequences of that are. But we do know for a fact that the consequences are deleterious, that millions of animals are dying, starving, being strangled, and caught by this trash. And so it's a dire scenario that is very little understood.
You said in your op-ed piece in the New York Times that plastics are the most common pollutants, but they're also as dangerous as climate change to life on Earth.
Well, what I said in my editorial was that it's a hypothesis that should be seriously tested. What happens with climate change is you get migration toward the poles, right? Things heat up at the equator and things can move. So you do lose species that can't maneuver out of the heat that's being generated and find a more temperate living space that corresponds to what they're used to. But humans can do that. Maybe a smart investment is buying real estate in northern Canada or Siberia or Patagonia or, you know, Tasmania, because we can move out of the way of some of these phenomena that are affecting the planet. But when you're caught in a net of plastic, you can't get away. It's a ghost fishing, they call it, and it's extremely destructive. And the traps that fishermen put out get lost, about 10% of them each year, and they are responsible for decimating about 10% of the target catch. So in addition to this kind of getting caught and tangled up in the stuff, there's this other phenomenon where these plastics accumulate pollutants, and they break into these bite-sized bits, and everything we found out there had bite marks on it. It's being chewed up. The ocean is a very sparse place. Animals have to swim a long way to find something to eat. So when they find anything that looks edible, they're going to sample it. And everything is getting sampled. All this trash has been completely chewed around the edges. And these bits that the animals are eating are poison pills. They're up to a million times the level of the pollutants in the surrounding seawater have been sponged up by these bits and are then transmitted through the food web. So you're getting a non-nutritive, non-digestible food mimic put into all these different species. Hundreds of species now have been identified as consuming this stuff. And so it's weakening the fitness of the marine life itself. This needs to be compared to what's happening with climate change and studied.
Let's turn to solutions. You've not been an advocate of recycling because there are some problems there. What are the problems with recycling?
Plastic is not like metal. The age of steel was characterized by a lot of recycling, all right? When replaced steel with plastic in 1979, the production of plastic in the United States outstripped production of steel. When that happened, you got a material that, in the first time in really modern human civilization, the product that defines the age of plastic, that product is not really recyclable in any major way. It has too many problems associated with it. Let me enumerate the problems. First of all, there's too many different types of plastics. You can't mix polycarbonate plastic with polyvinyl chloride plastic and get a usable plastic. You can't mix polyethylene plastic with polyvinyl chloride plastic or with PET plastic, polyethylene terephthalate, and get a usable material. You've got to separate them, but this is not what's done in manufacturing. In manufacturing, they're mixed together because they're used. One might be used for the cap. That's the polypropylene is the cap on most bottles. Then the bottle itself can be polyethylene or polyethylene terephthalate, so it's a totally different plastic. They have to be separated, then the labeling may be a thin sheet of plastic of another type. Then with your potato chip bags, you've got a sheet of aluminum that's been electroplated onto the plastic to keep moisture in from penetrating so the potato chips stay crisp. That's a whole other layer of problems. Or your Tetra Pak, where you're getting your milk and your soups and your juices in these cardboard packs, there's many layers there that are a nightmare to recycle. Only very few plants are equipped to even tear those things apart and try to get at recycling them. Then when you finally get the stuff separated, you've got to try to clean it, because if you don't clean it, it's not going to be purified in the remelting process. It starts melting at the boiling point of water, about 212 degrees Fahrenheit, 100 degrees Celsius. That's when your plastics start to melt. This is not going to vaporize greases, oils, contaminants, paints, all the things that you get rid of when you recycle steel or you recycle glass or you recycle aluminum, all those contaminants that get vaporized off and you get that clean metal substrate, that doesn't happen with plastic. So it's illegal to have food contact with recycled plastic because it doesn't get rid of bacteria. Even some nurserymen won't take pots for potted plants out of recycled plastic because they still contain viruses and bacteria that can harm the plant. So it's not purified in the remelting recycling process. So cleaning is very hard. Cleaning this stuff is very difficult because the plastic molecule is an open molecule that is very easy to suck up oily substances. That's why it's used in cleaning up oil spills. All those booms you see around oil spills are made out of plastic because plastic separates oil from water. It will suck up the oil and leave the water. Well, in sucking up the oil, it sucks up all the associated contaminants. So trying to clean that, you really have a hard time. If you've ever tried to maybe reuse a cup that you had some top ramen noodles that you did in the microwave and that little ring of chicken fat, that yellow ring, tried to wash that off with soap and water, it's a very difficult process. The stuff really sticks into the plastic matrix. So you don't purify it when you recycle it, and you have one heck of a time sorting it when you recycle it. Then you have the problem of transporting it to a recycling facility. It's like transporting air. The stuff is so light, especially when you look at the expanded polystyrene, the styrofoam kind of things. You can't make money filling a truck up with something that light. There's no weight to it. You can't get paid for your load. You've got to densify the stuff to make it denser, and that requires some centralized equipment. So it's very impossible, since it's such a universally used substance, and since it goes to every corner of the world, to get that stuff back in quantity that would give you value for your effort is impossible. So we've been created this monster, and we really don't know what to do with it.
I know that California's legislature passed a plastic bag ban. I believe it's the first state to do so in the U.S. Will this type of activity help?
Every little bit helps. We've got to build awareness that there's a problem in the first place. Most people attack things like the bottle bills and the bag bills as an attack on their convenience, as an attack on their freedom to do as they please and to have these convenient items. So that's because they don't realize the serious consequences of having all this stuff blowing around in the environment. So we've got to build awareness of these seriousness of the consequences of waste plastic getting into the environment by highlighting these dirty dozen, if you want to call it that, the most polluting plastic, which are the bags, the bottles, and a lot of the insulated food service things, the clamshells and the styrofoam cups and that sort of thing. You know, we have to go after the worst things first, the things that are showing up the most in our cleanups and so on. And those are the three things that are showing up. And you know, fast food is notorious for having the stuff. You know, we don't have trash compactors in our cars. We should, because people live in their cars, they consume food in their cars, and there's no place to put the trash. So it typically gets, the door gets open and it gets shoved out. I was just watching out my window the other day, and some young kids parked in front of the house, went to the beach. When they got back in the car, a girl took a furtive look around and no one was there. She threw a can of hard cider into my bell pepper plant, you know, because she just wanted to get it out of the car. You can't drive around with an open container in your car. That's illegal. So people are confronted with waste everywhere. Plastic is a space hog. It takes up more room in the landfill than anything else. And every time there's an event, the trash cans overflow because it's such a space hog. You can't really provide enough receptacles to safely contain it. It's going to be blowing around on the ground after any large public event. So there's a myriad problems with dealing with it, and banning those things that are the first ones that we see when we do our cleanups are makes sense.
What are the other potential solutions?
We have to look at a revolution in design. The product must be designed with end of life in mind. We have to have a circular economy. There must be a pre-cycling premium paid by the producers of this material so that they have an incentive to design it so that it's easy to pick up. We can't just externalize forever the costs of cleaning up pollutants that we make as part of our industrial system. Our industrial system has produced miraculous change in the way humans live, but it's at the expense of the natural world. And if we want to have really that non-synthetic habitat exist for ourselves, we don't have a lot of time, because we're turning the entire planet into a synthetic habitat. There are places in the world where people really never get out of a synthetic habitat and never really get to experience anything that could be considered natural. And they don't care because they don't ever see the natural world as having value. And the value is all part of their synthetic lifestyle. I'm very pessimistic because we're creating generations of city dwellers who don't experience any value in the things that we're screwing up with our trash. So they're not incentivized to do anything about it.
Charles Moore, I'd like to thank you for doing this research and sharing it with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Well, thank you for having me today.
When we come back, a group of pro-democracy advocates in Hong Kong have vowed to shut down Hong Kong's financial district should China change its freedom to nominate candidates democratically. What does this mean for democratization in Hong Kong and for the region? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Activists in Hong Kong took to the streets to protest China's limitations on who can run for office and have vowed to shut down the financial district through acts of civil disobedience. They and others consider it a violation of its agreement with Britain to maintain democratic structures in Hong Kong. What impact might these changes have on Hong Kong, on China, and the region? With us is Jeffrey Wasserstrom. He is the Chancellor's Professor of History at the University of California, Irvine. He's also the author of China in the 21st Century, What Everyone Needs to Know, Global Shanghai, 1850 to 2010, and China's Brave New World and Other Tales for Global Times. Also joining us in studio is Stephen Noakes. He's a lecturer at the University of Auckland and the author of The Role of Political Science in China, Intellectuals and Authoritarian Resilience. It's a great pleasure to have you both with us. I thought we should start with the historical context about how we have gotten to this place with Hong Kong and China. Jeffrey Wasserstrom, you're the historian. What do we need to know to understand the current circumstances?
Well, I think a couple things are important to know. One is that Hong Kong didn't exist as much. It certainly didn't exist as a city until it was ceded to the British after the Opium War in the middle of the 19th century, and it became a British Crown colony. And the idea was that it would always eventually revert to Chinese control, but that was very far in the future. So it developed, it grew rapidly into a significant international city as a British Crown colony. And then during the lead up to the time when the transition was supposed to happen in 1997, when it was going to revert to Chinese rule, one of the things that happened was that a deal was struck whereby mainland China agreed that Hong Kong would be able to be governed in a distinctive and separate way for 50 years after the transition, and that this would allow something that was described as one country, two systems, that would be in which there would be a very different kind of a protection of the kind of freedoms and speech liberties that were available in Hong Kong that were not available on the mainland, and that there would be a degree of democracy and forth that way. The other thing that's important to know is that there had been all sorts of limits on freedom of speech and on democracy when Hong Kong was a crown colony. But during the lead up to 1997, in fact, the British oversaw a period of loosening up and in which there became greater freedoms within Hong Kong, which then became things that people were very eager to protect after the transition went to control to being part of the People's Republic of China. So it was called a special administrative region. It's still described as a specially administered part of the People's Republic of China. And it's a fascinatingly unusual setting. We've never had the situation of a country controlled by a Communist Party government in which there's one zone within it in which there's all sorts of things can be discussed that are completely taboo in other parts of the country when there are different rules governing how the press operates and different rules governing issues such as the election of local authorities. A lot of us, at least I, was quite surprised at first by how far Beijing went in actually living up to these initial promises, that there did continue. You were able to say and do things in Hong Kong that would get you immediately thrown into prison in one part of the mainland governed by the Communist Party. But recently what we've seen is Beijing showing clear signs of putting limits on how far things can go in Hong Kong and reverting on some of its initial promises about moves toward a more open democratic society taking shape there. And we've had a tremendous amount of pushback from people in Hong Kong. And there's actually been pushback over the last 10 years and more by a series of times when Beijing has made moves to tighten controls and people in Hong Kong have pushed back, and often successfully, but it's always been difficult.
So when you say often successfully, how successful? What were the circumstances and who were the pushbackers, I guess I should say?
Well, I mean, one of the things that's really interesting to me is that what was often said about the people of Hong Kong 20 years ago and even more recently was that Hong Kong was a city where people really only cared about making money and didn't really care about politics. But what we've seen in the last period since the late 1990s is that people in Hong Kong care very deeply about, at least some of them care very deeply about certain kinds of freedoms. One example that I think particularly interesting was 2 years ago, there were plans floated to bring mainland-style patriotic education to the schools in Hong Kong that would be trying to make history and civics classes instruction in Hong Kong, focusing on the kind of nationalistic themes that are very strong in PRC schoolrooms, where, for example, you can't talk about things like the June 4th massacre of 1989. That can't be talked about on the mainland. It's not talked about in any mainland textbook. But in Hong Kong, every year they actually hold public rallies to commemorate the victims of the massacre of 1989. So when these plans came to introduce this new mainland-style patriotic education, there were large protests, largely involving high school students, who didn't want this kind of interference. And after those protests, the plans were tabled. And the idea of bringing those kinds of educational textbooks into Hong Kong classrooms were scuttled. So that's an example of a successful pushback. And there were also protests when there was a new law that would handle issues of sedition raised before that. Large protests have happened when people of Hong Kong have felt as though Beijing is moving very sharply in the wrong direction when it comes to keeping the kinds of promises of non-interference that were made in 97.
Stephen Noakes, what would you add?
A couple of things, actually. Mr. Wasserstrom, a moment ago, mentioned that some of the people of Hong Kong care very deeply about their freedoms, and that is certainly true, and I think that's what you're seeing on the street right now. The operative words, though, are some of them. What's not 100% clear to me is how widely or broadly pro-democratic sentiments are felt among the population in general. Obviously, this is not a moment when polling is easy or feasible. My gut feeling, though, would be that there's a significant component of the local population that, though perhaps sympathetic on one level to those demonstrating, prefers not to rock the boat too much. My sense is that there would be quite a number of people doing too well by the status quo to push pro-democracy movement or demonstrations too far. Certainly, they would be reluctant to disrupt the security situation to the point where there was major economic fallout.
And this would be the middle class.
Certainly. Average people who have a significantly higher standard of living than, say, counterparts in Shenzhen or other relatively well-developed parts of the Chinese mainland.
Then in terms of these changes that are being proposed by Beijing, what exactly are they?
Under what's called the Basic Law of Hong Kong, which was designed to facilitate a smooth retrocession process to Chinese sovereignty, constitutional development in the territory was supposed to incrementally head towards what was termed universal suffrage. And I think a lot of what you're seeing in the way of demonstrations now stems from the confusion over what precisely universal suffrage means in this context. broad electoral participation, certainly, but also, as Occupy Central sees it, the ability of essentially anyone to stand and run for office. The changes that have been instituted by a committee under the National People's Congress essentially limit, in practice, those people who would be able to stand and run for office. It effectively limits the range of candidates to those who would have very sympathetic ideas towards Beijing.
So it essentially limits what one would call free and fair elections.
It would limit what we would think of as open elections,
right,
in that sense. Yes. Now, under previous arrangements, one needed 1/8 support of a nominating committee in order to be put on the ticket. Now, with the recent changes, one requires 50% support of this committee, which makes it very, very difficult, as I say, for those who have strong pro-democracy sentiments to join the ticket at all. Theoretically, it would be possible, I suppose, for someone to gain 50%. But in practice, I think there's really no amount of statesmanship that can get that done.
Jeffrey Wasserstrom, what would you add to this?
I was just thinking that Evan Osnos of The New Yorker, who's one of the wittiest as well as best informed writers on China, and he's now covering U.S. politics, said that the situation reminded him of a remark by Boss Tweed saying, "I don't care who votes as long as I control who gets nominated." And, you know, it is a kind of mockery of open elections to get to choose among candidates, but have the candidates have to meet very stringent political litmus tests. And you know, there is selection, or there are elections of that sort on the mainland in which there is a choice between candidates, but only ones who are completely approved. So it's not surprising, I think, that this is seen as not a real move to democracy. But I was interested in the earlier comment, which I think is very important, that we need to note the diversity of Hong Kong population and the fact that people are going to have very different views on this. And I think it's very clear from the way the rhetoric coming out of the official press in Beijing is emphasizing certain things that are meant to appeal to those who may feel sympathetic to the protesters, but also wary of rocking the boat, which, you know, I think it's important to think in those terms. But Beijing is using terms like Occupy Central, they're saying, is creating chaos, will limit the stability of economic life within Hong Kong. And I think, you know, these are real concerns. You know, people want to protect their way of life, which has many dimensions, not just politics, but also economic and quality of life. But I think that's something that Beijing is very aware of, and they're trying hard, I think, to accentuate the splits within the city on this, on along those lines, largely class lines.
I saw in that same article they were calling the Occupy Central people extremists, to sort of categorize them as somebody that would be an outcast. At the same time, Occupy Central has said they want to essentially shut down the financial district. Is that even possible, Stephen Noakes?
Is it possible to shut down the financial district?
They're saying they're going to do sit-ins and they're going to do all kinds of civil disobedience.
To be honest, I'm a little bit surprised that this has stayed alive as a news item as long as it has. So maybe my predictions are not the most reliable in this sense. I wonder what kind of legs this whole thing has. It is certainly possible that there will be short-run tactics employed, characteristic of Occupy movements the world over. And I think that even small disruptions in the security situation, in the proper functioning, say, of a stock exchange, could have really wide-reaching ripple effects, both in Hong Kong and the mainland and around the world. As far as this developing into something more serious that destabilizes the territory in a grander sense, my crystal ball doesn't work any better than anybody else's, but I simply don't see it as having legs like that.
I think this was also in the New Yorker article. It might have been in the New York Times, talking about how Beijing wanted to be sure to not give in even a little bit to seem perhaps weak. That may suggest that they're going to be tough on protesters.
I think that that's true. They cannot be seen to be caving to the demands of a democratic movement, at least in a very public way, for fear of a sort of demonstration effect taking hold, perhaps in other pockets of the mainland. other areas of Chinese society where there's apt to be calls for broader reform politically than the party is currently willing to grant.
The agreement that was made when Hong Kong reverted to China also stated that there would be some continued freedom of press, independent judiciary, freedom of assembly, as I understand it. Is that also being stymied to some extent? Jeffrey Wasserstrom?
There's been an ongoing discussion ever since 97 about to what extent the pressures on the press in Hong Kong have led to self-censorship, have led to just various forms of indirect pressure being put on people and the infiltration by the mainland in various ways to try to control what goes on in the press. And it's kind of a half glass full or half glass empty thing, whether people say they're kind of surprised by how free the press has remained or they're just noting a creeping contraction. So there still is a way in which the press in Hong Kong says things that are just very different from what gets said openly in the press on the mainland. On the other hand, there have been some very disturbing recent things, including thugs attacking particularly outspoken journalists, and then what seem to be fairly trumped-up charges brought against some of them, not focusing on what they say, but being hassled on issues, on side issues, largely because of, it's seen as because of what they've been saying. So that would be a different kind of demonstration effect to try to kind of intimidate people. I mean, there's no question that it is a real night and day difference what you can talk about on a campus in Hong Kong versus what you can openly talk about on a campus on the mainland. You can have private conversations about many things, but you can talk about taboo subjects in the classroom. In Hong Kong, there's an ability to publicize things on the streets that you can't on the mainland. So there's still a very big difference. But the question is whether those differences would erode. The other thing with the demonstration effect, which I think is very important, is it's important to realize that the mainland isn't a homogeneous space in which the same pattern persists across the mainland. There's been a steady tendency for there to be there's a slightly more open press and more pressure toward democratization in the parts of the mainland that are just over the border from Hong Kong. In part because media blows over, people can pick up television from Hong Kong and things like that in Southeast China. And so there's been more percolating there. So what happens in Hong Kong is watched by all of the mainland, but particularly closely by people there. It's also being watched by Macau, which is another former colony that has a kind of special status since becoming part of the PRC. So people are watching very carefully there. So there's a very complicated political landscape there. There's also a different kind of watching or demonstration effect. What a lot of people had thought was that if there's any dream of the mainland still of eventually having Taiwan brought into the People's Republic of China as a place that would be able to be governed by separate rules, the success of Hong Kong or protecting things and having things be very different in Hong Kong would be the best possible argument for saying to Taiwan, to people in Taiwan, leaving aside whether many of them would want to be part of this in any way, shape, or form. But Hong Kong's being watched by at least some people in Taiwan as a kind of canary in the mine shaft to see if Hong Kong's separateness can't be protected and preserved, then there's no way to imagine that Taiwan's would be. So that's why I think, you know, Beijing's walking a funny kind of calculus where the push is to be tough to prevent a kind of demonstration effect to people who might be agitating toward democracy on the mainland. But by being the tougher they are, the more it's going to alienate people in Taiwan, even the people in Taiwan who might be most willing to consider some kind of eventual reunification.
I wonder also about this British inquiry that has been raised, what exactly it is. There's also some debate about whether or not it should occur. Stephen Noakes?
Under the terms of the Sino-British Joint Declaration, which was the product of collaboration between Zhao Ziyang and Margaret Thatcher in 1984, the UK made commitments to ensure the progressive development of Hong Kong's constitution following the handover. And now, on the heels of these events, a parliamentary committee in the UK is looking into whether or not Beijing has, in some sense, negotiated in bad faith or has failed to live up to an agreement here. Now, in response to that, we're hearing the same line from Beijing that is common in these circumstances, which is butt out. This is our sovereign affairs now, and it is no longer any of yours. Nothing particularly surprising about that. I would simply say that there are potential consequences for bilateral relations in general were either side to push too hard. If the UK is seen to be sort of ramming ahead with findings that Beijing has not kept faith, then that's going to have an impact. What that impact would look like, I couldn't really say. I can't imagine it would be anything as severe as trade sanctions or anything like that. But on the other hand, the UK does have obligations to live up to.
Jeffrey Wasserstrom.
I think there's a good reason for the international community to be concerned about Hong Kong. I mean, I think Britain has a particular stake in this because it's promises that was made to Britain when this deal was being worked out. But I think in general, there are all kinds of agreements that organizations are reaching with Beijing in one form or another that are based on the idea that Beijing lives up to the promises it makes. So that if this is seen as Beijing having made a deal contractually to do certain things and now backtracking on that, I think this potentially has implications for all kinds of international actors who are saying, how can we trust that Beijing will do in 5 years what it says it will do in 5 years if a deal that was supposed to last for 50 years is now being reneged on this soon? So to be very specific, in the case of universities, there are Confucius Institutes, which have become the source of some controversy, whether because they're the main actor in China is tied to the government. Can we trust the deals that are made between agreements that are signed between a Chinese state organization and an American university or a Canadian university or wherever around the world? If Beijing is seen as not living up to its promises when it suits them to backtrack, then I think this has implications for every organization working out an agreement with the Beijing government. So I think this is why, even though it may seem like a small matter in some ways or a very specifically regional matter, I think if it's framed in terms of whether or not one party makes good on its contractual obligations, then I think this has ripple effects that could be relevant for actors around the world.
Jeffrey Wasserstrom and Stephen Noakes, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Last week, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon appeared at the University of Auckland to receive an honorary doctorate. Here are the highlights from his speech.
Ladies and gentlemen, today I'd like to briefly review the current global landscape. New Zealand is my final stop, but I'm going back to New York today, this evening, but it began from Bali, Indonesia. I went there to attend the United Nations Alliance of Civilization meeting. And this is quite an unfamiliar name, not much recognized by other people. But if you see that there are so many natural calamities in our world and heartbreaking, like disasters and diseases, and one thing is that the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, we are mobilizing all United Nations agencies and funds and programs and tools and resources to first of all provide the medical support and contain the further spread to other countries and help those countries affected for economic and social and health systems capacity buildings. What really troubles us is that there are so many man-made crises. We are living among multiple crises. There is a lack of mutual understanding and respect for belief and understandings and religions of other people. That's the beginning of the conflict, which we are now experiencing, sadly. That is why United Nations, at the beginning of my term, has created an alliance of civilization to promote genuine understanding and help resolve these fundamental problems through respecting each other, understanding better and deeper the religious belief and whatever one may come from, wherever one may come from. We have to address root causes of the problems which we have to address. The first, Middle East, is a case in point. We now have an extended open ceasefire in Gaza. Our goal is open the space for political process, political resolution of this issue, which has been over six decades of problems. That is the only way to achieve lasting peace in that region. The peace between Israel and Palestinians has global and regional and global implications and is a core of the peace in the Middle East. While we are seeing relative calm at this time, only after 50 days of destruction and killings of people and destruction of the society, we have to bring two parties to the negotiating table and bring all the problems which have been already identified and let them resolve this issue through a dialogue so that Israelis and Palestinians can live in peace and harmony side by side. Israeli people have a legitimate right to live in peace without fear. At the same time, Palestinian people should be able to live without under the condition of occupation. Their movement, their freedom should not be restricted, and their society should be reconstructed. That's what I'm going to do, and that's what I'm now actively discussing with the parties concerned. Turning to the abhorrent situation in Iraq, I have appealed to all the religious and political leaders in Iraq and in the region to stand up for tolerance, mutual respect, and nonviolence. First of all, we have to protect the human lives. We have seen such a brutal killings by Islamic states. And again, I'm condemning in the strongest term today the brutal beheading of journalists yesterday. This is totally unacceptable. Such kind of inhuman, brutal crimes, which is a crime against humanity, those perpetrators must be brought to justice. And this is a firm policy of the United Nations. I refuse to accept that whole communities can be threatened by atrocity crimes because of who they are or what they believe. We have to make all our society free from believing in and practicing what you believe. At Eastern Europe, I'm deeply concerned about the border situation between Ukraine and Russian Federation. Lives are at stake. Peace in Ukraine means peace in the region and beyond. It has, again, global implications in peace and security. It's not confined to that area. I have been speaking to the leaders of both Russian Federation and Ukraine. I have been urging them that they should sit down together and discuss all these issues. If there is any grievances and complaints or misunderstandings, that's the only way, that's the best way. I have been discussing this matter with Western colleagues, European Union and Americans, and again, I'm calling them to resolve this issue in a peaceful way. At the same time, the United Nations has deployed humanitarian assistance team as well as human rights monitoring team together with OSCE teams. And we are doing our best under very difficult, dangerous situations to protect human lives and to provide humanitarian assistance who have been affected. Now we have many other troubles. In Syria, the situation has been continuing for years. More than 3 million people have become refugees, and more than half of their total population, 11 million people, have become affected. They need urgent assistance from us. And the situation in South Sudan, Central African Republic, Libya, Mali, Democratic Republic of Congo, they are always problems. And many people are still being killed at this moment. I'm not going to go down all these countries because of time limit. The United Nations is dealing with the consequences of these destructive forces. We have more than 120,000 peacekeepers around the world in 16 missions. Just today, again, I condemn the attack that killed 4 Chadian peacekeepers serving with our missions in Mali. Last week, 44 Fijian peacekeepers were detained. It's not clear when they will be released. And our team in Golan Heights, our force commander and our negotiators are actively engaging with the rebel, these armed groups, to have them released as soon as possible. I have been urging them, demanding them, to release them unconditionally, immediately. Attacking peacekeepers who are engaged in peace mission is a crime against humanity. It's a totally unacceptable one. And I have spoken to a Fijian prime minister, assuring him and people of Fiji that we will do our utmost efforts to get them released as soon as possible. Our courageous blue helmets went there to bring stability to the people. I have condemned these attacks in the strongest possible terms again. Ladies and gentlemen, since the birth of peacekeeping, New Zealand has contributed military and civilian personnel to our operations. Since the beginning, inception of these peacekeeping operations, New Zealand has been contributing and working in at least 40 different missions to bring peace there. One of its first engagements was in my country, Republic of Korea, in 1950. New Zealand sent troops to rescue the Korean people from the war. I was just 6 years old at that time, so I didn't know the meaning of what is known as collective security in the Charter of the United Nations. I was too young to know that. But I knew that Korea was not alone. Korea was supported by the international community, by the United Nations. I knew that the world was by our side. That has given me a strong image about the United Nations. United Nations was the beacon of hope, our savior. Now standing and working as a Secretary General of the United Nations, I'm humbled whenever I see so many people around the world, they look to the United Nations. They still regard United Nations as the beacon of hope. Then how can I meet the expectations of them? How can I deliver all what they need? That really makes me humbled and gives me an added motivation that I should work even harder and harder. As you know, peacekeeping carries a high price. Since the beginning of these peacekeeping operations, more than 3,200 people have paid their ultimate price in the course of delivering peace. They died in different circumstances, but they all died in the course of peace. The best way to honor their memory is to carry on their unfinished missions. That is what we are doing. The United Nations peacekeeping missions and civilian personnel, they're working day in and day out in a very difficult and very dangerous circumstances. We know that this military means and forcible means are effective, sometimes effective. The best way is to resolve all this issue without using any forcible means. That is why the United Nations has a group of mediators and negotiators at standby. Wherever there may have some symptoms of crisis or active crisis, we are able to send our mediators and negotiators, envoys, within 48 hours. We are always on standby. But you should know that it is not always peacekeepers and envoys. United Nations civilian personnel, they are also working very hard. We have seen many civilian personnel who have been killed and died for various reasons in the course of doing humanitarian and human rights missions. Our new initiative, Human Rights Upfront, puts human rights at the heart of our fieldwork. It's the first thing that we have to protect the human rights and protect the human lives. After that, we try to resolve all other issues. The United Nations vaccinates more than half of the children around the world. We feed some 90 million people in 80 countries. We help more than 38 million refugees and others fleeing dangers, including 3 million refugees. We provide them food and sanitation and water and clothing daily. The life-saving work is only possible with the support of all member states of the United Nations. I ask you, be a global citizen. Do not care much about your national boundaries. As President John F. Kennedy said, there is no national boundary now. There is only the question how you can help others who are in need of your support. As I said, borders have practically lost its meaning at this time in this very dramatic transformation in global communication and trade and transportation, then we are living in a very small planet Earth. This planet Earth may be a very small, tiny star in the vastness of the universe. Then the answer comes naturally, quickly, that we are family of this small planet world, and we have to work together as one family members, regardless of where you are coming from, what kind of person, what kind of belief you may have. Use your enormous power of connectivity to speak out and take action. Be fearless in standing up to injustice. Let us work together to make this world a better form where everybody can have a life of dignity. And I thank you for this opportunity and thank you for your commitment and leadership. I wish you all the best. Thank you.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to our guests, to Anki Nagasyan, Melissa Chiprin, and Mike Hurst for making today's show possible. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can always check the archives, www.scholarcircle.org or the archives at kpfk.org. Please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.